From the Media Factory, in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Andrea Williams, whose new book for middle graders is Baseball's Leading Lady, Effa Manley and the Rise and Fall of the Negro Leagues, the true story of the first and only woman inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Before Jackie Robinson broke Major League Baseball's color barrier in 1947, black athletes played in the Negro Leagues, on teams coached by black managers, cheered on by black fans, and often run by black owners. Andrea Williams has written the true story of the woman at the center of the black baseball world, Effa Manley, co-owner and business manager of the Newark Eagles. Elegant, yet gutsy, she cultivated a powerhouse team. Yet just as her Eagles reached their pinnacle, so did calls to integrate baseball, a move that would all but extinguish the Negro Leagues. On and off the field, Effa hated to lose. She had devoted her life to black empowerment, but in the battle for black baseball, was the game rigged against her? Andrea Williams is an author and journalist who worked in marketing and development for the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in her hometown of Kansas City, Missouri, before turning to writing full-time. She now lives and writes in Nashville, Tennessee, with her husband and four children. When I spoke with Andrea, I began by asking how she first heard about Effa Manley and when she decided to write the book. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
My degree is in sport management. I graduated from Georgia Southern University in 2004 with plans of working in a front office. I wanted to be the first female general manager of Major League Baseball team. At that time, Kim Ang, who has now become the first, she takes that position now this season with the Miami Marlins. She was named to that position last. It was sometime in the fall, winter of 2020. But at the time when I was an undergrad, she was an assistant at the assistant general manager with the Yankees, and I knew she would beat me. I didn't think it would take till 2020, but that was the goal. I was saying that I wanted to be first, figured I'd come in at least second behind, you know, Kim Ang, but definitely wanted to run a baseball team. I wanted to work for a small market team, actually. So, you know, had these Moneyball visions even before I knew what Moneyball was, before the book and movie were out. But I grew up in Kansas City with a small market team, and just, you know, I didn't want to go work for the Yankees. I didn't want to, like, you know, help market or try to convince players to join, you know, this perennial powerhouse. I wanted to, you know, I'm the person who, if my team is not in the game, I'm rooting for the underdog. So that was the career vision that I had. I ended up going back home to Kansas City. And Bob Kendrick, who's the president of the museum now, was the marketing director at the time, and just created a new position, basically like kind of his assistant. So marketing and development, but helping kind of lighten his load. You know, nonprofit world, everybody's doing 50 million things. I was going to take at least a couple of them off his plate. And the first day that I was there, he gave me a tour of the exhibit. And it is set up, the focal point of the exhibit is what is called the Field of Legends. And there are these life-size bronze statues positioned around the field of, you know, these great Negro Leagues players. And you
Did you say life-size figures?
Life-size bronze figures.
That's pretty cool.
You can't take the field with them, though, until you have learned the story of black baseball. So you start out literally in the 1800s when baseball is becoming the national pastime, when, you know, black players were playing even for a short time with, you know, and on teams with white players. You know, then we come to this gentleman's agreement kind of kickstarted by Cap Anson, where we see segregation. And, you know, we walk along that history, the creation of the first Negro National League by Rube Foster in 1920, all the way around to Jackie Robinson's integration when he takes the field with the Dodgers. And then the dying years, if you will, of Negro Leagues baseball. So after integration, what does it look like when a lot of these owners are just trying to hold on to teams? But really, for the most part, everybody has shifted to Major League Baseball. Well, about halfway through there, there is this picture of this woman with her husband. And I'm like, who is that? Like, this is, you know, if you know anything about the Negro Leagues, there were women who played, Mamie Peanut Johnson and Toni Stone. They are at the tail end of that timeline. This is post-integration. But here we are in the 30s and 40s, and there's this woman, and I know that, you know, it's not a huge exhibit, so she must be there for a reason, right? So I started, you know, asking all these questions about who she is and what she did. And Bob told me about her. And then I started doing my own research and was just immediately intrigued by what she did. It was, you know, it was all of the things that I thought that I wanted to do. And, you know, here was this woman who did it, but who did it in the 1930s and 40s. So, yeah, and did it on the highest level. You know, her team won the Negro World Series in 1946. You know, so many great players came from her team. Don Newcomb, Monty Irvin, Larry Doby, who became the first Black player in the American League after Jackie became the first in the National League. So she put together a really, really good team and ran that team. So, yeah.
That's awesome. That's so much fun. And especially given the background that you had your eye on, like, what you wanted to do with your career and be the first. And then you come across this woman. So do you mind if I read a quote from the book?
Go ahead. I have not read it since it came out, so I'm like interested to hear what you
Well, this
reading.
Is from very early on. And I liked how you summed up. Okay, I'll just read it. Effa loved baseball, to be sure, but it was more than just the crack of the bat and the thrill of triumph that drew her to the game. She saw the Negro Leagues as a vehicle to transport the Black community to a position of equality in American society, to provide jobs and financial stability where they were sorely lacking, and to give Black boys and girls regular opportunities to witness victory when so much of their lives was mired in defeat. I liked the way that you just sort of summed up what she was all about. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you think, what her attributes were that contributed to her success as a businesswoman and an activist.
Yeah, I think that she just, you know, she was just one of those people who would see things wrong in the world and try to fix it. You know, I think we all, you know, we know when things aren't right or when people aren't treated fairly. I think a lot of times problems seem too overwhelming to overcome. But I think she just had that tenacity and resilience and was like, I'm going to try to fix it, right? Before she gets into baseball, and she leads this boycott of this department store in Harlem that, you know, generates 70% of its sales receipts from the Black community, but won't hire Black sales clerks, right? They are literally in business because Black people are shopping there, but they won't give them jobs. And she's like, this is ridiculous, right? Like, you know, I don't think she was the only one who saw this. And this is not to take away from, you know, anyone else who maybe couldn't, you know, for whatever reason, step up and try to affect this change. But she did. Effa certainly had a degree of privilege. You know, she was a fair skinned, you know, Black woman. She was beautiful. You know, she was well connected in Harlem. You know, this is during the era in the 20s where, you know, 20s and into the early 30s where you've got, you know, she's staying, living around some of these luminaries that we hear about, right, during the Harlem Renaissance. So she was able to leverage all of that to, you know, affect change in this community that she lived in and that she cared so deeply about. And yeah, I just think she had that. She was just born with that. I'm going to fight. I don't know if I will win. Right. And we see that, you know, throughout her story is that sometimes she won and sometimes she didn't. And sometimes when she thought she won, she really kind of didn't. Right. Like there's losing that comes with the winning, but she was willing to fight. I think that is the biggest takeaway from this book. I tell people that, you know, it's possible to change history. You just have to not be willing to play by the rules sometimes. And Effa was definitely that, you know, if we go back to that scene where she's standing or sitting across the table from the owner of the department store. And she's like, look, well, what are they going to do if you don't hire them? What work is prostitutes? Right. And it's like,
right.
If we consider the era, the fact that she's in the meeting is already monumental as a woman. Then she has the nerve to speak up. Then she has the nerve to say that. Like, this is a woman who's like, I'm not really all that concerned about social norms. Like, I am trying to affect change and I'm willing to do whatever it means to get to that. So, Yeah, I think that shows up in Effa throughout her story. So before baseball, while she's in baseball, and even after.
It's interesting. That moment that you just mentioned was such an interesting moment, because I felt like she really could read her audience, because there were certain people in the room where when she said that, it really could have damaged her. But there were enough people that needed to hear that and be shocked by it and actually reflect on it later that she said it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think she's just going off, you know, all the time.
You're 100% right. I think she was astute enough to see, like, because at this point, they've gone round and around with this thing, right? Like, they had already met with this owner, you know, the pastor who worked alongside her to lead the boycott. He'd already met and sat down with this guy and presented the sales receipts. So even saying, you know, again, 70-75% of the sales receipts are coming from the Black community, surely this proof, you know, these literal receipts are enough for you to hide. That wasn't enough, right? So now Effa's in the room and she's like, look, we got to do something else, right? We got to take it to the next level. We can no longer rationalize with this irrational person. So maybe it's time for me to make some jaws drop so he understands how serious the matter is.
Yeah. That was a great moment. So the book mixes Effa's story with the story of baseball history and American history and the history of the Negro Leagues. So can you talk about one of your other favorite figures from the history, all those histories that I just mentioned?
Yeah, I think Gus Greenlee is probably my favorite.
Okay.
He's such an interesting guy. He has this, you know, again, this privileged background where, you know, he's a Black man who, you know, was born in the 1800s and, you know, coming up during this time where, you know, it means something to be Black, right? Black people are definitely considered second class citizens, but he has relative privilege. He is lighter skinned and his, you know, he's in a position where he can be well educated, all of these things, but he is drawn to the streets, right? So, you know, he moves to the Pittsburgh area and starts running rum. And then he starts running numbers and is doing all these things to build this empire. But as we saw from a lot of men during that day, and there were actually quite a few Negro Leagues owners who made their money in the illegal number system, which was actually the precursor to the legal lottery system, right? But they took that money and were able to funnel it into these Black teams or into the Black community at large. So here's a guy who is technically, who's making his money by technically illegal means, but who then is able to become the bank of Pittsburgh's Hill community for the other Black people around. So we're in the throes of the Great Depression and Black people are out of work, right? Like Black people are last hired and first fired. So really we feel the depression in the Black community for a very long time. So he is there, he's buying groceries and paying doctor's bills and paying rent for people. And also has this team, has this Black Pittsburgh Crawfords team that he wants to be the best Black team in the country and is willing to put whatever money into that he needs to, right? This is how we see, you know, a Satchel Paige. The world is introduced to Satchel Paige through Gus Greenlee. Gus Greenlee also built his own stadium so he can keep more of that money to funnel back into the team and into the community. You know, during this time, very few Black baseball team owners own their own stadium. So that means they're giving up a hefty chunk every single game just to rent stadiums from white team owners. That means a lot. That's why most of these teams are operating on a shoestring. But Gus Greenlee is savvy enough and has enough privilege. You know, he has the money to go make more money, right? So that he can kind of, you know, evade all of that. Now, of course, there is a later fall from grace and he, you know, is pushed out of the Negro National League that he built. He built the second Negro National League after Rube Foster's first one died. He started the East-West All-Star Game. But, you know, he had his hands in some other pots. He was managing boxers and things like that. And ultimately, you know, fell from grace a little bit. But I just think he's such a remarkable figure. And, you know, we don't talk about him enough. You know, Effa was inducted into Cooperstown in 2006. There was a special election that was designed to, there was a special committee pulled together that was going to go back through make sure there were no other Negro Leagues players, managers, or executives who were worthy of induction, but that hadn't been inducted yet. And they started out with this ballot, and I don't even remember how many names were on it, but it was a lot. And they culled the list down to 17 who were inducted, which includes Effa. And Gus Greenlee was on that initial list, but didn't make the final cut. But I stand firmly that he belongs in the Hall for what he did for Black baseball, for sure.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Now, you're obviously very knowledgeable about baseball, and I'm just wondering if you knew enough from the get-go to write this book, or did you have to do added research?
Yeah, that's a good question. I did have a really, really solid foundation. So for journalists or people who write nonfiction books, you know, a lot of times you're spending a good amount of research finding the story. You know, you're digging in, and you know, you're pulling all the stuff together. Half of it you won't use later. You're just really trying to find the nuggets that are relevant to the story you want to tell. Sometimes the story changes once you start your research. I came in because of this foundation of having worked at the museum, you know, working at the museum, having to have enough knowledge to give tours. You know, we had a traveling exhibit while I was there that went to a different baseball stadium every weekend during the summer. We'll park out front. So as you're coming into the ballpark, you know, in New York or Seattle or Oakland or whatever, you know, you could come in and tour and see, you know, learn a little bit about Negro Leagues history. Someone from the museum, you know, was there. So, you know, I would travel out and have to be able to talk to fans, to lay fans, really, who didn't know anything about the Negro Leagues, about this important era of baseball history. So the foundational knowledge was there, which means that, yeah, it makes it a lot easier to kind of write that initial outline, you know, that I use for the proposal to get it sold to a publisher, you know, to even know where to start to do the research. But yeah, there was definitely some additional research that had to be done for sure.
Okay. All right. Great. Now, your audience is probably broader than YA. I, for example, love the book, and I am not a teen.
Interesting. It's actually, so when I queried it to agents, I queried it as YA. And, you know, my agent and I kind of talked about, do we do YA? Do we do middle grade? And so we left it as YA. But we, you know, when it went on sub, it went to auction. And every single editor I talked to was like, we should probably age it down. And this just speaks more to the industry than anything else. So it's technically upper middle grade. It's for ages 10 to 14. And the thinking behind that is that the middle grade nonfiction market is a lot more robust. Probably because at the YA level, if you want to read a history book, if you want to read a nonfiction book, you can read up to adult, right?
Sure.
The reading level gap there is, you know, most books for adults are written at, like, you know, maybe like a 10th or 11th grade level. You know, even for those that are pretty rigorous. So we wanted to age it down, again, because the support would be there for sales and marketing, but also with the idea that, yeah, we might catch, you know, some more reluctant YA readers. And also, you know, I keep telling people in all the interviews that this is me doing Disney, right? Like, it is packaged for kids, but it is 100% something that adults, you know, can enjoy and get behind and learn from.
Right. So what might you have done differently as the author of this book for an adult audience, or let's say for that 10th, 11th grade? Like, what would have changed, do you think?
I don't think anything would have changed. I think I would have gone deeper on a lot of stuff. I think, you know, it was really important for me to provide the context around Effa's story, as opposed to just writing, you know, a standard, like, here's Effa's story and that's it.
Biography,
you know,
I don't. Right. Sure.
Right. But especially considering, you know, the subject matter, like, I don't, you know, this is not like, we're seeing a lot of stories about, like, you know, World War II and like these women who worked as spies or code breakers or whatever. Most kids have a general understanding of World War II and what it was, when it happened, that kind of thing. But coming in and talking about the Negro Leagues, I'm understanding that there's probably very little background knowledge. And I didn't want to present a book that kids couldn't even read, you know, or fully grasp without having to stop every few pages to go look up something, to go check out another book, you know, to serve as supplement to this one. So, and I also wanted to make sure, I feel like, you know, with kids, you know, in history, we teach in snapshots, and then we leave it up to kids later to try to connect all of these dots, right? We present an individual and their story as this kind of, you know, absolute isolated thing. You know, we'll teach World War II as another separate thing, and we'll teach the integration of baseball as another separate thing. But all these things work together. So I wanted to provide that context. I couldn't talk about the significance of Effa's career without talking about why we have separate Black teams and leagues to begin with. And, you know, without talking about Gus Greenlee, who created the league that her team was in, without talking about Rube Foster, you know, who really provided the inspiration for Gus's Negro National League, because he created the first one in 1920. So all of that had to be in there. That said, I didn't want to give a book to kids that was like 500 pages long. So there was a lot of, you know, a lot of places where I could have gone deeper, that there just wasn't the space to do it.
Great. I followed a recent thread on your Twitter feed. I've been really interested in this, actually, concerning like the obfuscation of racial and gender disparity. Okay. On your Twitter feed.
Yeah.
And it gave me a lot to think about. But actually, just bringing it back to Effa's story, it strikes me that Effa's success as an owner all those years ago sort of makes your point. She was fighting more bias than she, of course, would have as a white woman. And yet, you know, her success as a woman of color made inroads for all women, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, just as far as like that conversation and taking it back in time to when Effa was.
Yeah, I think that so. There's a couple points to that. But I think that ultimately, when we talk about the gender issue versus the race issue, this country's original sin is a race issue, right? The thread that you're talking about was me talking about like country music and what happens here and how we choose who to fight for and that kind of thing. But ultimately, this country, you know, when we decide who is going to be enslaved, we're not doing it by gender, right? Women stood alongside the men. We're talking about country music. Country music is created as a marketing category. When we say, okay, we need to divide Southern music, it's not divided amongst the women and the men. It is Black race records and white hillbilly records. Black people understand this. If you talk to Black women, particularly during Effa's era, I'm not saying that women's issues don't matter, because they do, but the race issue takes precedent, right? If we go back to suffrage, white women are upset when we get to this point of like, who is the next amendment going to be for? Who's going to get the voting right for? The white women are upset because Black men get the right to vote before they do. Black women are like, this is ridiculous. I understand that you want to vote. We do too. But also, let's keep in mind, you currently have your husband, your brother, your father who can vote. We don't have anybody. Yeah. We don't have anybody. So when you are Black or when you are of another marginalized community, because that is how this country is established. Again, this is to say nothing about the gender issues that ultimately grow out of that. When you put too much power right in the hands of a tiny group, yeah, it gets unwieldy. So yeah, we're gonna look down on the women too. But ultimately, it starts as a race thing. And I think Effa, we see throughout her time, she's not really, some of the men certainly bring up her gender for sure, but they are also welcoming in a way. This goes back to, you know, Kim Ng just in 2020, you know, being named as the first female general manager of a Major League Baseball team. Effa is really pretty much accepted in this space because nobody has time for the gender issue. We're fighting for the race issue. It really is a bit of privilege. And I've said this in the context of country music too. It really is a bit of privilege to be able to say, oh, well, I think we need to fight just for the women, or, oh, I think we need to just fight for the queers, or, oh, I think we need to. That requires so, because you're able to say that because on the whole, you as a race are there already. We're not even there. Right. We're not even there. We can't even talk about Black women or Black queers. We just need to get Black people in the door.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So I was going to read something from the book. This just made me sad, actually, because I just feel like this is so long ago. This was written almost 100 years ago, right? Almost 100 years ago. This is from Alan Locke. He was the first Black Rhodes Scholar, among other things. He wrote an essay on race in 1925 called Enter the New Negro. This is just a little excerpt from it. So for generations in the mind of America, the Negro has been more of a formula than a human being, a something to be argued about, condemned or defended, to be kept down or in his place or helped up, to be worried with or worried over, harassed or patronized, a social bogey or a social burden. I won't keep going. You have a longer excerpt in your book from that, but it's 100 years ago, right? and it could be today.
I think that's a really good point. And I'm glad that you took that from it because that was definitely intentional. You know, I got some early reviews that are like, I don't know, is Effa's story being overshadowed? And, you know, as a writer, like I first of all, I just got to say, I am the writer that reads every review. I don't ever see that changing. I know
every Amazon review though, right?
I don't really have any reviews right now on Amazon. It's mostly just ratings, but I've read the Goodread reviews. I don't see that changing, right? Like I'm the person, like you go to the doctor and you're like getting a shot or blood drawn or whatever. I want to see the needle go in. Like I want to know exactly what to expect. So yeah, I saw that and it kind of like, it's one of those things that like, obviously, you know, it stings a little bit if people don't just love your stuff, but also I wouldn't change it. I think, you know, and I talked about this before, it was, I felt it necessary. You know, this was something that my editor and I like really focused on and putting this book together and making sure that, you know, it wasn't just an Effa Manley biography, but that it did talk about, you know, all of these things in Black history, because to your point about how much has or has not changed in 100 years, I say this in the context of country music too, you don't have to be the people that built the barriers in order to be complicit in upholding them. Right. You can just show up and go with the status quo and be just as guilty because the status quo is racist. And so what happens is, and this is me, you know, assuming the best of people, we don't really know how bad it is. We don't really know how much intention, how much care was paid to keep people, to keep Black people to the lowest rungs of society. If we understand that, if we understand how at every turn, Black people were kept down, were pushed down. Here, we've created our own leagues. Oh, you don't want us to play with you? Great, fine, we'll do our own thing. Then you decide that integration should happen. And now you're penalizing us. Now we can't even be compensated for the players that we developed. Again, we see this constant disregard, disrespect for Black people and who, you know, what we created, who we are, what we did. If kids understand that now, yeah, I think that is the best way to ensure that we're not 100 years from now having this conversation right now. I really think that, you know, we saw this last summer with everything going on in the world. We're dealing with adults. This is why we had so many, you know, anti-racist reading lists floating around the internet, because so many adults, we don't understand, you know, we don't teach history well in this country. That's number one. And even when we do, who controls the pen? Who gets to decide what histories we are told and how they are presented to us? So, yeah, if we get kids to understand this now, when they are the ones, you know, on Capitol Hill, when they are the ones in the boardrooms and the front offices of Major League Baseball, I think that they will be more likely to counteract some of these sins of the past.
Yeah. Just to your point about how inequitably these teams were treated. Rube Foster, who launched the first Negro National League in 1920, he died tragically, probably related to this gas leak that gave him sort of brain disorder. But he had sought to create an organization free of white involvement. And in the end, he owned a team when he died. In the end, a white man bought the team that he owned, and his widow got none of the proceeds.
Yeah.
How is that possible?
It's quite possible. Now, obviously, Rube was very savvy. You know, he created this first Negro National League and was, you know, so focused on making sure that everyone was a success. You know, he shows up, you know, he's pulling together these owners from these other teams. And, you know, they're going to have a conversation about whether they should, you know, start a league or what that potentially would look like. And they sit down, you know, in 1920 at the Paseo YMCA in Kansas City, Missouri, and he pulls out the Articles of Incorporation. Like he's got this really astute business mind and is already thinking towards the future. So I would like to think that there was something, you know, on record that would have provided his wife and his children with something once he passed. But even if there was, I mean, again, we're talking about the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Talk about the 1920s. even if there was documentation, how do you get it enforced? You know, maybe you can, maybe you can't. You know, it's, you know, now whoever this owner is who knows how powerful Rube's Black baseball team was. The Chicago American Giants were one of the most powerful, one of the most, you know, lucrative teams in all of Black baseball. If you want to cut the Black Widow out of the situation, out of the financial pot, it's pretty easy. It's pretty easy, especially in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's tragedy all the way around.
Yeah, there is. The other thing that I thought was kind of interesting once I thought about it is the fact that Effa's success ultimately sort of led to her own failure, in that the league's success was destined to make it fail because white leagues would step in to try to scoop up all the best players. Do you agree with that statement or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that success, you know, it's the more money, more problems situation. I think success certainly brings heightened attention, but it also, in the context of this story and integration and the way it was done, there's this confluence of factors. It is the success of Black baseball, these really successful teams and really, really talented players. But it is also, again, you know, World War II, we're sending Black men to fight in this war, and Black men and Black women, we're sending overseas in this war effort, and they come home and they are second class citizens. We have this greater push from the Black community, like, this is unacceptable. Like, now, you know, because of the war effort, you know, you've got Black people who are getting defense jobs where they hadn't before. Now, white, you know, these hiring managers, these manufacturing plants can't afford to say, you know, well, we're not going to hire you because you're Black. They needed all hands on deck. So we're starting to see progress in other areas, which naturally makes people say, on the whole, where before it was a conversation happening in baseball, to be sure. Wendell Smith at the Pittsburgh Courier is in 1939 asking white managers and white players, how do you feel about having a Black player in Major League Baseball? Would you play on a team with a Black player? Would you coach a Black player? Conversation was already happening in the baseball circles in the Negro Leagues. But once we really get to this World War II period, it is loud. And it is outside of baseball. It is the community on the whole. So all of those things together lead us to this moment where integration is imminent. You know, you've got Branch Rickey, who's now with the Dodgers, who's trying to build this team into a powerhouse club that rivals the one he left behind in St. Louis. All of those things work together that create this situation where Branch Rickey's going to move the way Branch Rickey always does, which is that he wants to build a team without spending really any money. Mm-hmm. And because the Black community has been pushing so long for integration, they really have conditioned themselves to accept integration in whatever form it comes. The Negro Leagues end up being a casualty in the sense that they provide the players that baseball, that Major League Baseball needs, that Branch Rickey needs in order to execute its ultimate mission.
All right. I always like to ask my guests what they've read lately that they might recommend to listeners. Have you had time to read lately with everything?
Yeah, I don't read as much because here's the thing. I can't read while I'm writing, particularly not in the same space, right? So, you know, if I was reading while I was working on this book, it would have been adult for sure. Probably would have been adult fiction. But, you know, I write across Asian genre. So there's always some kind of like mixing it up. But so I will, because we're talking about, I really think it's important to read widely. I think, you know, you write middle grade, don't just read middle grade, right? You write adult, don't just read adult. So because we're talking about my middle grade nonfiction, I will recommend a couple of adult fiction projects. Luster by Raven Leilani. Every review, even the ones that are like, I don't really know if I liked it, everyone talks about this woman's use of language. And oh my gosh, it is incredible. Like, we follow each other on Twitter, but I haven't had a conversation with her. But I'd be curious to know, you know, how much goes down in that initial draft, right? Like, is she just getting bones down and then coming back and prettying the language later? Or is it really all just coming out at once? Like, when I'm drafting, I like to draft pretty quickly just to get on the other side of it so I don't get stuck and then, you know, want to swim back to shore. But, you know, and every now and then, in the best case scenario, like, you're in the clip and it's coming and it's flowing and something will just drop out and it's beautiful and it stays through through the next 10 drafts. A lot of times it's not that, right? Like you come back and you're like, okay, I don't want to say walk right here. I need to like punch that up. And so I wonder how much, because it is just every, I'm a slow reader anyway, probably because I am a writer. So I end up rereading passages and pages like two or three times. Mm-hmm. And this woman's book is impeccable with her use of language and really, you know, really innovation. And I caught myself all the time reading stuff like I've never, ever, ever heard this thing described in this way. You know, a lot of us, because we read so much, we end up picking up bits. And, you know, I can read a little bit. I can see a little bit of this in this other person's work. Like there's none of that. Like she does such a really great job of thinking outside the parameters, I think, of what we're used to. And then Saving Ruby King by Catherine Adele West. Kathy is a really good friend of mine. And her book is really great too. It's also literary fiction. So really, really great use of language and a really great story about, you know, Black people and what it means to be Black and in the church and in families that have struggles and issues and how do we overcome these things? And, you know, what does love really look like? What does love look like when it's messy and all those things? So those are the two for sure. But I am excited about, I just bought The Some of Us by Heather McGee. It is nonfiction and it is talking about some of these things, you know, that we've been talking about today and, you know, in the context of my book. But I love that she, you know, I've listened to a couple podcast interviews that she did and she talks about this draining the pool as a method of, you know, it's The Some of Us refers to this kind of zero sum game in terms of how we approach racial equity. And she really, this terminology of draining the pool, which is that, you know, and she illustrates it in such a way that it makes it super clear. And I think that's why I'm so excited to read it, because I think a lot of times, particularly when you know a subject well, there's a challenge in communicating it to your audience so that they get it as well as you have it. But her using this illustration of, you know, we get it, it's an actual pool, like in these, you know, suburban communities, you know, park departments, you know, taxpayer dollars create these swimming pools. And then as we approach integration, they would rather drain the pool than have Black people come in and swim the pool. So what ends up happening, obviously, is that it's not just the Black people who don't get to swim. Now the white people don't get to swim anymore either, unless you are, you know, financially privileged enough to be able to join a private club or something like that. So this drain the pool, this zero sum approach that this other group can't win unless I'm losing, ends up setting up her discussion about all of these other things, you know, with college, you know, when it was mostly white men going to college, it was paid for, right? But now that we have more minority people showing up and wanting to get higher education, now it's a loan game instead of a, you know, a government grant game. So I'm excited to read that again, not just because of what she's talking about. I think it's important that we understand this again. How do we really understand today and create a better tomorrow? It starts with learning from the past. I'm just excited because I think this is going to be something that people can really, really grab onto because of how well she's illustrating it through this pool situation. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Good. Now, you mentioned a minute ago that if you had been reading adult fiction when you were working on Baseball's Leading Lady, you would have ended up writing adult fiction. Do you write fiction?
I do write fiction. I have, it's middle grade is the next thing that will be coming out.
Oh, I was going to ask, what are you working on now? Okay.
Yeah, it'll be, so this book is done. I'll get copy edits back in like next week, I think. But it is done. I wrote it during the pandemic. It's not announced yet because it is, it's a special book. Publishing is so weird with all of the secrets, but it is it's a collaboration with myself and someone else. And it has not been announced yet.
So you don't have to name the person, but how did you like collaborating? I'm always curious how that goes.
Well, I started out, you know, my initial transition from journalism to books was via collaborations, ghostwriting.
Oh.
And so I like it. I mean, I do feel that I was put on this earth to tell stories and to help other people tell their stories. It's always something, you know, that I enjoy. I obviously enjoy some projects more than others, but I do I do like it. I don't do as much as I used to because I've got my own stuff that I'm working on. Sure. But yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Great. Now, you mentioned before that you have an agent and you have a publisher that you found when you were getting this book out. I'm wondering if you can just talk about your publishing journey, either with this book or maybe whatever your debut experience was.
So this is my, I had another agent when I was ghost and co-writing who would set up all those projects. But for this one, that was just going to be my first solo endeavor. I wanted a new agent. I wanted someone that was really strong in kid lit, because while I do write across age and genre, the first book is for kids. So I wanted someone that could really, really, particularly because kids nonfiction is a different thing. It is a different animal altogether. And I wanted someone who you know, had a really strong track record in that space that could give me the support. And, you know, I didn't think that this would be as big as, like, you know, the Hunger Games or, you know, like these, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we're having these conversations about history, how important history is. And I read all the things. Like, I love fiction. I don't read as much fantasy as contemporary, but I do read some of everything. But it's always interesting to me that the market says, or that, you know, the publishing industry says that, yes, history is important and we need more of these own voices, stories or whatever, but nonfiction just is not as sexy as some of this other stuff, particularly in kid lit. So knew that I needed a really strong team. And my agent is Sarah Crow, Pippin Properties. And Pippin, you know, they have Jason Reynolds and Catherine Applegate and, you know, Kate DiCamillo. So Aaron and Trotta Kelly is actually signed to Sarah too. I'm going to forget Nina LaCour, but really, really strong track record. So, I had multiple agent offers within like the first week and a half of Query. And Sarah was just, she got it. She really got it really quickly. And also gave me the freedom to do all the other things. Like I joked that like my two top questions for agents were, this is not really a joke, I really did do this. I was like, you don't have to like sports, but understand that like the vast majority of my stuff will be sports, you know, because I did have some respondents who were like, I think this is a great story, but I'm not really into baseball. And I'm like, okay, I think it's bigger than a baseball book, but if you're that averse to sports, this is not gonna work, because sports shows up a lot in my work. But also, can I do all the things? You know, can I, after we sell this thing, can I also give you some adult fiction? And can I give you some YA fiction? Can I give you some adult nonfiction? And she was really excited about all the things that I want to do. So I signed with her. It was March, early March of 2019. We were on sub by April 1, and the book went to auction. The auction closed the Friday before Memorial Day of 2019. So sub to close of auction was about 2 months, which I was really excited about. Again, because this is kids nonfiction and like, who cares about nonfiction, right? So, but you know, Sarah definitely errs on the side of, you know, I don't want you to get too excited, but she felt really strongly about it from the beginning that it would do well in the market, and it did. So
excellent. That's fantastic. And you went with Roaring Brook Press, I should say that.
Yes. And Megan is incredible. Megan, you know, I had five or six editor calls, and Megan, you know, she's a sports fan, but had also been assisting another editor at the house that, you know, does this kids nonfiction for this market. So she was like, I really do feel like I've been working my whole career for this book. And I was like, so no, no, but she was great. Even in terms of, you know, she is a white woman. And so I was a little concerned about, like, are you going to be able to help me create this thing that I need to create that really is a love letter to the Black community, and, you know, really highlighting these incredible things that we did so long ago, and really hopefully inspiring the next generation of Black leaders. And she did. And she was great about saying, you know, I think you can dig deeper here. I think you can provide more context here. Or I know you want to throw this in, but we don't have any more space. So, you know, she was really great about that process. Yeah, I don't have an official acknowledgements page. Like, I want to thank my agent and my editor and my kids. And I don't have that because we were like, she was like, I don't want to put anything else in here because we don't want to scare the kids away. So, yeah, it is. She was fabulous to work with. I think across the board, Sarah, Megan, the entire process, it was, I couldn't have asked for more.
Okay. Fantastic.
That maybe to not have published during COVID, but other than that, everything's great.
My last question is always a question around advice for other writers. And you know, I kind of will sometimes focus it for people. What I have written down here is, do you have any advice for writers who want to write biographies for younger readers? But, you know, do you, if there's another piece of advice you'd rather give to writers or another focus where you'd like to take that, that's fine too.
Yeah, I think I would say, and this is certainly applicable to people who want to write nonfiction for kids, but I think also regardless of what you write, for me, like if you go to a bookstore right now, there are lots of Jackie Robinson books that talk about the integration of baseball. And this book, Baseball's Leading Lady, is about more than just that moment, but that's a pivotal moment. but these other stories are always told from the perspective of, you know, there's Jackie in there for sure, but really the lens is through Major League Baseball. You know, here's Branch Rickey, who is the savior, who is signing him. Here is, you know, his white teammates. And, you know, what is it like for them to have this black guy in the locker room now? And who takes to him more quickly than others? And what is it like when they're out on the road? And yeah, Jackie's experience is in there as well. But we never get the side from the Negro Leagues. What were those people, you know, what was his former coach going through, or his former teammates going through, these teams in leagues that created the Jackie that Branch Rickey was able to sign? What is happening there in that community once Jackie crosses over to Major League Baseball? So my advice is, when we're thinking about telling stories, you know, a lot of times we see this, well, we should rewrite the story from the villain's perspective, right? We've got the heroes, let's get the villain's perspective. And I'm saying, let's actually think beyond the lens that we've always been trained to see through, and think about the people that history has previously put on the periphery. What's their story? Mm-hmm. How do they think of, what do they think about who was cast as the hero and the villain? They might both be villains when it's all said and done. Maybe they're both heroes. We don't know. But so many people, we haven't had their voices at all. And yeah, I think that's a great way to make sure, particularly if you're writing nonfiction, that we get the full breadth of these stories. You know, Effa, for me, it was, we got to talk about Effa because why is no one talking about Effa, right? And that's because we haven't deemed her story necessary. When we talk about baseball, it's like we got Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson, who played in the Negro Leagues, and Jackie Robinson, who became the first in Major League Baseball in the modern era. And that's it. Everybody else's story is tossed to the wind. And but why is that? So, yeah, I think we need to dig deeper and not just recast the same characters, but also think about the people who have been left out of the story altogether.
Okay, that's fantastic. I want to mention again, the name of the book is Baseball's Leading Lady, Effa Manley and the Rise and Fall of the Negro Leagues by Andrea Williams and published by Roaring Brook Press. Andrea, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been really wonderful, and the book is so illuminating. I loved it.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm glad you loved it.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. You've just heard an interview with Andrea Williams, author of Baseball's Leading Lady, Effa Manley, and the Rise and Fall of the Negro Leagues, published by Roaring Brook Press. You can learn more about Andrea's work at Twitter. Her feed is at Andrea Will Write. In our conversation, Andrea Williams and I discussed a moment in history when Effa Manley spoke up at a meeting. Not only did she speak up, but she suggested if the store that she had organized a boycott against didn't start to employ African Americans, those potential employees would be forced into such lines of work as prostitution. and she didn't say it that nicely. It was a bold move, and it worked. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about a time when you took a chance to better a situation, putting yourself at risk for a good cause. This could be a situation that arose at work, or it could be about that time you convinced your mom that your brother really hadn't been the one to break a vase by throwing a baseball in the house. Give yourself over to that memory and write about it. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. So as I've been doing every week, I'm going to close out the show with thoughts about the pandemic. It's not over. Lots of hopeful news about vaccines, and it seems like we've gotten past our super spreader events of the holidays and the Super Bowl, but it's still really important to wear a mask, to maintain distance from other people, to try not to gather in groups unless you can be outside and spread out. Just be careful. This really will come to an end at some point and we can get back to normal or some sort of normal, but it's not over yet. I'd like to encourage you to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs, and following their virtual book tours and finding your way to their books. As Andrea Williams mentioned during our conversation, it's a hard time to have a book come out, even harder than usual, and it's never easy. For all of you who are trying to write these days, do be sure to check out the archives of Write the Book, because each episode does offer a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, lots of podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. And I want to just mention that the format of the show might be changing in the near future. I'm ready to kind of shake things up a little bit. So if you have certain thoughts about things you like and things you don't like, I'd really love to hear from you. And once again, the email address is writethebook@gmail.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.